Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
There was a 1% in medieval Europe. There was a 1% in Renaissance Europe. There was a 1% behind starting many of the wars, including most particularly World War I and World War II. These were both projects of the monetary elite, the international monetary elite, acting through the economies of different nations. And these elites have learned to manipulate the economies of the world through the use of debt. Privately owned banking systems that have the ability to create money in various national currencies and to loan that money out at interest, because they've been given that privilege by the governments that are subservient to them.
That's Richard C. Cook, author and U.S. Treasury Department economist, who has done significant work around the history of money and banking, and today is Ellen's guest, who will describe the ways that we've all been bound into a system of debt slavery. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute. Today, you'll hear the litany of historical reasons why our monetary system doesn't work for the vast majority of people who depend on it, and why it works brilliantly for those who profit off of it. That's coming up later in the program. Plus, we'll also be hearing from Mike Jacobs, the author and historian for the Bank of North Dakota's Centennial, who will also share some of the methodologies that help preserve that successful bank's operations. Hint, governance is the key to successful public banks. But this week, we're also celebrating the California legislature's passing of Bill 857, which authorizes municipal public banks in the state, a development that has shifted the national landscape toward opening new pathways for public banks across the country. Leave it to California, right? We'll be talking with key public banking advocates there who helped move that important success story forward. But first, we've got a brief report from Ellen on her recent article that addresses an admission by central bankers that their house of lending cards is getting played out.
The central bankers are now admitting that their tools aren't working, that they're out of ammunition. But their solutions are not to say we need to be less independent and maybe work for the government for a change. Their solution is to try to take even more power away from the government. So this paper said that they were out of ammunition, that negative interest rates were virtually their only tool left. I mean, they've gone down to zero, and negative interest rates have been tried, and that hasn't worked. It hasn't stimulated the economy. So they're suggesting that maybe they need to actually work with the government to combine fiscal and monetary policy, which is a good idea. In other words, that they would print money and the Congresses in different countries would come up with their fiscal plans, things they wanted to do with the money, and then they would tap up the central bank to print it and issue it and spend on these programs, which is what Japan does, and it's worked out very well, and it's what China does in a different way. But anyway, basically, that's what they do. So this is actually a very good idea. He's right. That is the solution. They've got to work together. But the way they set this out rather deviously was that the oversight on who would get the money would be in the hands of independent experts, which is basically means technocrats of the sort that ruined the economies of Greece and Italy. Even if they've got all the algorithms and all the data, and supposedly they would be determining what the best way is to execute these policies. But the question is, best for whom? Like, it still should be a political question, not a central bank question. So they're attempting to take even more power away from the government and make those decisions themselves.
You'll recognize the points that Ellen's just illustrated in her interview later on in the program with our guest Richard Cook, and you can read more of her latest articles on her website, ellenbrown.com. But now, we're going to turn our attention to the big news for public banking coming out of California. For the first time in U.S. legislative history, a state has authorized creation of municipal banks, and in the process, broken through notional legal constraints against public ownership of the banking franchise.
We're really pleased to have today the two triumphant participants in California who helped to get public banking going with the Public Banking Institute back around 2010 and 11, Mark Armstrong and Susan Harmon. Mark is currently the president of Commonomics USA. He was our executive director for a good while. And Susan has most recently has been working in Oakland on helping that city to drive the public banking effort in Oakland. But both of them very deeply involved in really leading the fight for how to develop the legislation that we're celebrating here, the California Bill 857. Tell us what this California victory looks like to you. Mark?
Thanks, Walt. And we'll be triumphant, by the way, once this bill is done by the governor, assuming he does that. So what it means for California is really straightforward. The issue that we were facing for a number of years was really who's going to go first. And so you had a number of people in government, whether it's the state or some of the larger localities, who were just waiting for other political leaders to lead. And what we did was Susan received a call from a San Francisco Lawyers for Civil Rights, reached out to Susan about 2.5 years ago and asked basically how they could help in terms of pushing public banking forward with a study that would be done by David Holt, which is a law firm out of New York. Long story short is we very quickly centered on state regulation and what can be done at the state level to influence bank charters or licenses. There's different ways of using that term. But basically, we were focused on the bank charter. And out of that conversation and out of the legal memo that they wrote was a definition that, yes, they could create a new license for what would be public banks. And it may solve any one of a number of different issues that people were facing in the conversation about public banks. And so what was really welcoming about that memo as well as that entire discussion was this realization that the path forward for public bank may not be to ask for a public bank, but may be to simply ask for a new license, which would be legislation written at the state level, and it would provide authority to the Department of Business Oversight to issue this new public banking license. And so that's essentially what the bill is, the AB 857, is a public banking act. It's a way to basically create a template which would establish the ground rules for how public banks are formed and at the municipal level within the state of California.
So what are some of the changes that had to be made in law to accommodate this?
Well, the only one that really needed to be changed was the prohibition on counties lending their credit to anybody. Other than that, charter cities, who are called home rule cities in other states in California, have the power to start public banks. Charter cities have a great deal of power in California. But we did want to make provision for accepting county money as deposits. So that was the beginning of the legislation. And our intent was that it be very light, leaving lots of decisions to the next layer down, which is the State Department of Business Oversight and their regulations, and then the final level, which is the local level. We wanted most of the decisions about these banks to be made at the local level. But as we progressed through the legislature, it got heavier and heavier.
Well, you know, one of the lessons we've learned and one thing we know is that we'll get resistance kind of at every level. If you look at the only bank that's been established in recent memory is the Bank of American Samoa, and the Fed resisted for 2 years before they gave him a master account because they didn't want to establish a precedent. And they never did get FDIC insurance, probably because they'd be taking risky depositors. I don't know. But anyway, so we know that, and the treasurers tend to resist. So these amendments that were made, you can just imagine, they were saying, well, the thing is, the people wanted it, and that was shown, and I think that was what was really so strong about this bill, that there were, was it 180 groups that supported the bill, and, you know, just massive public support. So that showed the legislators that they really needed to do it, and then if they, you know, made their amendments to say, well, okay, we'll do it, but in other words, that's kind of expected, but still, I think it was a great landmark showing, particularly for just the machine that you got going to get this bill passed. I'd like to hear all about that, what the procedure was. I know, Susan, how you are, that you're always out there walking from office to office, knocking on doors and stuff. So I'm guessing these young people from L.A. and other places, the young millennials, they've got the support, massive support and the enthusiasm, and you've got a lot of knowledge about how to get around the legislature up there in Sacramento. So I'm imagining that was a great team. And then Mark, of course, you wrote it, right, the original bill, so that was great too. Anyway, I'd love to hear how the campaign worked, you know, how you promoted it.
The first issue was finding an author. And that took us, and we did not have an author until the last possible day for filing this bill. So that was the first hair-raising moment. And I can't remember how this came about, but the legislature held a hearing on public banks very early on in January or February. And that was a huge boost to be able to have on the record statements by a lot of people. They asked us to testify, of course, and the Department of Business Oversight and various other supporters and opposition, both. So that hearing kind of set the stage for the legislation. And then there was finding the authors, which we did, and we had a pair, one from San Francisco and one from L.A., which I think was also helpful. So we went through three committees in the Assembly and the Assembly floor, and then three committees in the Senate and the Senate floor, and back to the Assembly floor for concurrence. And each of those committees added annoying provision. And there was a crisis point, I think, when we were on the Assembly floor, where I made it clear to our authors, who very much wanted this bill to pass, that we might have to choose between the bill and actually starting banks, that there were so many onerous provisions at this point that it was going to be very difficult and will be very difficult to start banks. And one of our authors, David Chu from San Francisco, did say that at a hearing, that he just kind of cautioned. Well, I think he was trying to say that these banks will be very safe because we've added so many provisions for oversight that they're so safe that they may not even be able to be started. But there was a moment of crisis where we really had to point out that the point of it all was starting banks. And if the bill made that impossible, then we kind of missed the point.
What impresses me is that most bills are backed by big money, you know, some big group that wants to push these things through. But this bill was totally grassroots and totally no money, I think, right? No money supporting it.
Absolutely no money.
So that is what is so impressive to me, that you got so far with it. But, yeah, I know the discouragement of having all those roadblocks thrown up.
Everybody had said we would need a lobbyist, that we'd have to hire a lobbyist. And, of course, we had no money. And I myself have a bias against lobbyists. I think we were more effective as the clearly volunteer and enthusiast, passionate. Passionate became a word that everybody was using about us, including the California Bankers Association. When they used it, it was meant derogatorily. That, oh, well, we had a lot of passion, but we didn't know what we were talking about. That was kind of the way they used it. But I think our passion came through. It was clear that we weren't paid lobbyists, and we did the San Francisco, San Diego, and Oakland's lobbyists, all the city's lobbyists, did testify at various stages, all of them at some point or another, which was very helpful. We had, I think it was 13 cities and counties around the state that supported the bill. explicitly supported the bill, endorsed it, along with, as we said, 183 organizations, including huge statewide unions and lots of environmental groups, 350s from all over the state. We just did an amazing job of signing organizations onto this bill.
Trinity Tran was our unpaid lobbyist in the sense that she was she had the ability to pull all these organizations together, these different cities, their representatives, and as well as all the volunteer advocates who were calling into their representatives. And so it was a massive effort led by Trinity, and any one of us played a number of different roles in the huge effort, but there was tremendous coordination going on that was done by CART.
So restrictions notwithstanding in the bill, is it not fair to at least claim a victory for codifying municipally owned banks as part of an authorized state government function?
Yes, of course, it's a huge victory.
The fact that we've established that we can have a public bank, cities and counties can have public banks. Mendocino County, for example, had a quite strong push for a county bank, and they got stopped by that law that said that a county can't issue its credit. Of course, we wrote legal memos and said, no, that's not what it means. The law goes back to the 1850s, and it was, you know, intended for something else. But that is not enough. That didn't persuade. But if you actually have a legislature look at it and say, yes, we're going to change this, you all can have a public bank, that isn't what it means, then that's got authority behind it. And the fact that we'll have hurdles, as Susan said, that there, it's going to be such a safe bank once we get these things set up that nobody can really object to it.
Mark, in your national work many years ago, I mean 8 years ago at least, you brought public banking into public awareness. The front voice for this, in addition to Ellen's writings, but you were talking to people all over the country about this. And without the benefit at that time of California's approving not only this legislation, but not even approving legislation that was begun back in 2011. So as you look at the national picture now, do you think that this is going to make some sort of a difference that's going to help to facilitate new initiatives?
Yes, I do. And the reason why is because I think that the educational component associated with this particular bill in California has really opened the eyes to a lot of folks. So now people understand that a municipal public bank has a very important role to direct and influence the economy of that particular region. You know, there you can look, if we were to take California as an example, you can look at there being a three-tier structure of public banks. One would be the infrastructure bank at the state level, which could fund very large infrastructure-type projects. Municipal banks can do more commercial lending in partnership with community banks. And then you also have postal banking, which can provide retail banking services to banking deserts, whether it's in Oakland or in more rural areas. And so there's this crystallization of awareness throughout the country that, you know, that public banks can play a very important role in any one of a number of different areas. And so with this piece of it, the municipal public banking being so firmly in place now, not completely, I mean, we still need the governor's signature, but I think what we're going to end up seeing is a lot more education and realizations happening, because one of the key things about education is when you compare things and you see the differences, you learn a lot more. And so when you can compare the different approaches to public banking, all of a sudden people's eyes are going to be even more widely opened and recognize the importance of having any one, if not all, of these pieces in place.
So where does it go from here? What kind of provisions do we have in terms of how many cities can be involved, and which ones do you think might take the leap?
One of the Senate committee chairs insisted on making this whole project a pilot program. The way that has played out in the legislation is that there will be a limit of only two bank licenses, public bank licenses, issued a year, up to a maximum of 10 over a period of 7 years, and then the law sunsets. And the Department of Business Oversight will do an evaluation of the program. So the three areas that will be first, we are sure, will be LA, San Francisco, and the East Bay. in some unspecified order as yet. So the next step is for the alliance to pull together and try to support each other as we start this process. The next step is for the three communities to set up their boards and to get business plans written. The law takes effect once the governor signs it, January 1st, and then the Department of Business Oversight will have to write regulations, but we're hoping that they will be as light as we intended the legislation to be. These are really commercial banks, just with a different mission statement and a different board of directors and a different bottom line. Other than that, they're really just commercial banks, so they shouldn't have to write up elaborate regulations just for us. It doesn't seem necessary to me. I would love to have an application in by January. Our problem in the East Bay is that we haven't been able to raise the money for the business plan. That's where we're stuck right now. But as of our meeting last Friday, we have a few new leads for foundations. And I think that the passage of the legislation, because of its symbolic value, will also open up some pocketbooks here and there.
I just want to thank you, Mark Armstrong and Susan Harmon, for all of the work that you've done to bring us to this seminal point for public banking. So thanks again for being with us today. And
thank you, Wolf.
Thanks, Wolf. Ellen.
Great talking
all right.
to you. Great work. My guest today is Richard C. Cook, a former federal government analyst for several U.S. government agencies, including NASA and the U.S. Treasury Department. Rick was instrumental in exposing White House cover-ups regarding the 1986 Space Shuttle Challenger disaster and wrote a book about it called Challenger Revealed. His experiences as a U.S. Treasury analyst positioned him to write a book in 2008 called We Hold These Truths, The Hope of Monetary Reform. And he has done an interesting six-part video series called Credit as a Public Utility, The Solution to the Economic Crisis. It's posted on our Public Banking Institute website under videos if you want to check it out. So, Rick, it's great to be talking to you.
Thank you. You too, Ellen.
So you've laid out some very interesting proposals for how we can transform our debt-based monetary system into one that's more geared to supporting the physical productive economy. So just to lay some groundwork, can you walk us through how we got off track? We were obviously very focused on industrial productivity during World War II, and the economy was at its strongest in the two decades after that. So how did we get diverted from industrialization to the financialization that consumed the economy today?
Well, we speak of we, meaning, of course, United States. And oftentimes people lose sight of the fact that the United States is only one player on the world stage. The United States likes to think it's the most important player, of course, but historically, and even today, despite the prominence of the U.S. after World War II, when we became the Western world's biggest producer because everybody else's economy was in a shambles, the U.S. is only part of a global financial system. And we've learned through various resources to think of, let's just talk about the 1%. You know, this is a term used very effectively by Bernie Sanders, for instance, and a lot of other people. The 1% is the global financial controllers. There was a 1% in medieval Europe. There was a 1% in Renaissance Europe. There was a 1% behind starting many of the wars that have taken place over the last couple centuries, including most particularly World War I and World War II. These were both projects of the monetary elite, the international monetary elite, acting through the economies of different nations. And these elites have learned to manipulate the economies of the world through the use of debt, privately owned banking systems that have the ability to create money in various national currencies and to loan that money out at interest, because they've been given that privilege by the governments that are subservient to them. This is where the Bank of England came from. This is where the Federal Reserve came from. And even though in the 19th century, the U.S., through the Industrial Revolution, became a tremendous economic powerhouse, the control of the industries that developed at that time were very quickly taken over by the big banks. The power of the banks has never seriously been challenged in this country. And the way the banks function is to produce booms and busts, the so-called business cycle. It's not really a business cycle. It's a inflation and debt cycle, or an inflation and crash cycle. The biggest one in recent history was the 2008 housing bubble that was entirely created by the banks through fraudulent means, as you've written about yourself very eloquently. And when that crashed, we had the government bailout, which was just another big bubble. And so it goes. And the winners are always the financiers, more accurately, the people who control the financiers, you know, the people at the very, very top who have the wealth of the world in their hands. And the losers are always the people who work for a living, the workers, the housewives, the students who are in tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. It's become a crisis. The whole system is collapsing.
And you have written and spoken about how in the 1970s things changed. We went off the gold standard, and I've written about it too. Well, anyway, there were devious things going on that made oil. Suddenly we had an oil price shock, and prices went up. There was inflation globally, and it was blamed on governments printing money. But, of course, we know that's not really what happened. And the central banks became independent, and, you know, what we have today, independent central banks. And governments were no longer supposed to borrow directly from their central banks, and they weren't supposed to issue money themselves, but they were supposed to borrow on the open market as if this would maintain a stable economy. But, obviously, it hasn't. What it's done is just financialize everything. And you've explained why that doesn't work. I mean, you can't just have a finite amount of money. Obviously, you're going to, I guess we have to go back to money is created as a debt at interest. The debt is
right.
Anyway, that whole progression of how we got enslaved by debt and how we got away from actually having the central bank fund the government.
Yeah, what money should be is a surrogate for tangible goods and services, for real production. It shouldn't just be a toy that banks use to run up profits by putting people into debt and engendering inflation, which then will crash the economy, and then the banks step in and seize property that has gone into default. This is what we see over and over again. And we're seeing it today again because once more there is a housing bubble. Once more people buy a house and then they think they can cash in 2 or 3 years later by selling it at an inflated price and walking away with the money. So you just see this over and over again. We do not have a financial system that is based on real value, on tangible production. And that's what we have to return to. And what is probably going to happen, and you have to look to writers. I'm just reading a book by Chris Hedges now called A Miracle, The Farewell Tour. And what he means by that is this is the last gasp of America on the world stage because we've hollowed out our economy. The only production left is in making war material for the military-industrial complex, including what we sell to other countries, and the ability of individuals to earn a living outside of that has disappeared. And it also affects the towns and cities where they live, where most American cities that are not supported either by high finance or military production have gone bankrupt or soon will go bankrupt. And we see from that the things like the opioid crisis, many other indicators of social failure. All of this is coming to a head. And one way or another, such a system built upon such illusory value must crash. And time will come, and it may come very quickly, when the government can't bail the banks out anymore, because the credit, which has been based upon purchase of U.S. securities by countries like China, Russia, Japan, and so on, that's all going away. They don't want it anymore. They're creating alternative economies in their own currency. So all of this is coming to a head. And when it goes down, we must have the knowledge and the ability to be able to put a functioning monetary system in place to support a revitalization of actual production. And that, I think, is what is going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And what particularly interests me about your work, or what I particularly wanted to talk about today, was your dividend economics, as you call it, your proposal to pay everyone a national dividend, rather like the universal basic income that Andrew Yang has been talking about, and it's in the news because he made it to the national Democratic debates, but he would fund it with taxes. And you're proposing, and I would propose to fund it by printing the money. I mean, the Federal Reserve could do it, or the Congress could do it directly. And we argue that that would not be inflationary. You actually need something like a universal basic income, and you need it routinely. Like, it's not just one payment. The argument now is that, well, you could do that until you hit full employment, but then you've hit a ceiling. You'll run out of workers, and therefore, if you put more money in the system, you'll just drive prices up. So could you explain all that?
Well, John Maynard Keynes explained it very well, and people forget where Keynesian economics came from. Keynes observed back in the 1920s, 1930s, that because the income from production that was earned by an industrial economy did not flow back into the economy through wages and dividends, at least not in its entirety, there was always a gap between income and production. And as you indicated, Major Douglas in England had already identified this prior to Keynes. In fact, they would debate with each other now and then. The way that John Maynard Keynes tried to solve the problem was through government deficit financing. And what deficit financing was for Keynes was mobilizing the unused credit of the nation. That is to say, he knew that the nation could produce more than could be purchased by the working economy for various structural reasons, including savings and reinvestment. Because when businesses withhold dividends or withhold fair wages in order to grow, in order to cover their depreciation, that purchasing power is pulled out of the producing economy. So Keynes said that ought to be put back into the producing economy by government deficit spending, and it would be paid for by the growth of tax revenues that resulted when the economy began to grow again. It's called priming the pump. And we were all familiar with that, you know, back in the 60s and even up until the 70s, when that idea was killed by the takeover of the economies by the banks under the circumstances that you described. And so from that point on, the way to get extra purchasing power into the economy became bank lending and inflation. That's why we've had such a tremendous inflation over the last 30, 40 years, because it comes from banks pumping debt into the economy. And the way that anybody tries to overcome debt is by raising their prices in order to pay off the debt and pay off the interest on the debt. It's a never-ending treadmill that eventually destroys an economy. And what Douglas says, you don't have to have the government borrow that money in order to reintroduce credit. What you have to do is calculate how much additional credit is needed in the economy to pay for what is produced and for what people need to live on, and simply issue that credit to them directly. So it's not really printing money in the way they speak of today, where the government borrows and then prints the money through various schemes and gimmicks that they use. It's actually issuing what he called a national dividend to each and every individual adult within that economy. It doesn't have to be a huge amount. If you issued that to every person, you would actually reconstruct the economy at the working level, because people would then be able to apply that dividend to their own jobs, to their own livelihood. And so you would actually see a rebirth of local economies. Today, local economies are dying everywhere because the banks don't find it profitable to lend to people who live out in small towns or former industrial cities. They're just left to die, the people and the economies out in the hinterlands. And that's why Trump was able to tap into so much anger and fear out in the American hinterland, because the banks which support Trump destroyed their economies. And so the misery of those people became what Hillary Clinton called the cry of the deplorables, which was a real cry, a genuine cry. But what they got was nothing. What they got was deception, lies. And we're seeing that every day. You open the paper, look at the internet every day, and you see the consequences of that massive hollowing out and destruction because of the failure of our leaders to harness the productive power of our population at all levels in all localities, and instead to turn everything over to the banks, to the big financiers, to Wall Street, to the international investors, and so on. And those people have nothing to say when it comes to rebuilding an economy from the bottom up. And that's what the national dividend that Douglas and many others advocate would do. Andrew Yang has the right idea about the basic income, but he doesn't have a clue as to how the economy is structured and what to do about it. And Bernie Sanders, by the way, endorses universal basic income. What he has said is that he supports Yang's ideas, but he feels that a basic minimum wage, Medicare for all, have to come first because people are dying because of those things. We can't wait. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that. I think if we've restructured the economy totally, and, you know, we're talking about a monetary revolution, let's not mince words, it could turn around fairly quickly. But not a single one of even the progressive candidates for president have dared to step up and say a bank-based economy is what is destroying the world, and it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, the pushback we always get, the argument that we always get against printing money, is that it will cause inflation. So how do you explain that one away? I've got my explanation.
Well, that's a real laugher, because what has driven the inflation, and if you compare the economy today even to the early 70s and see the extraordinary inflation that has taken place within the economy, what are they talking about? Putting more money in at the ground roots level would cause inflation. They've destroyed our economy with inflation through their debt-based bank system. The banks produce constant inflation by creating more and more financial bubbles. And then when these bubbles burst, they come in and buy up assets for a fraction on the dollar. And then the whole thing starts over again. So the argument of causing inflation, it's worse than grade school economics. It doesn't even make kindergarten economics. It's historically false. It's a myth that the Federal Reserve has been putting out for decades. Every time the unemployment rate inches down a few tenths of a percent or a few points, they crank up interest rates because the additional activity that is going to be produced by that economic improvement, you might say, they're going to skim the cream off of that pretty fast and be sure that all of the profits of that go into the pockets of the banks. So the whole thing is just nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Well, my arguments are, first of all, you could print or issue or get a lot more money out there than just hitting full employment, because the first thing that will happen is that people will pay down their debts, and money is created as
right.
a debt, and it's extinguished when the debt is paid off. So that money is just right. going to disappear. Second thing they'll do, or maybe the first thing they'll do, is save some money. It is said that I think it's 40% of the population doesn't have $400 in it, to
right.
couldn't come up with $400 in an emergency. So if you're in that, your family is in that situation, you're going to hoard that money for a while. You're going to want to build up your nest egg. Maybe if you have some extra, you might want to try investing in the stock market, which wouldn't hurt anything. I mean, if the stock market goes up, that doesn't really hurt anyone because it's just a casino anyway, as we know. I mean, you're just betting against other people, and people want to jump
well,
in.
The biggest, well, the biggest inflation bubble we're seeing right now is the stock market. Your ideas and mine dovetail here because I have advocated in my proposals for a dividend a series of local public banks because you say that people are going to want to save their money. Well, yeah, they will. And where can that money be saved? It can be saved in local public banks, which then can use their lending to build up the local economies.
Yeah, when they talk about inflation, they're only talking about consumer price inflation. So, one problem I had for a long time with the whole C.H. Douglas argument was that, well, okay, that money goes to bankers, but bankers also spend money, or it goes to suppliers, but they also spend money. It goes to insurers, but they also will put it back into the economy. I mean, that's the argument you see, you know, that money's not lost, it's gone somewhere, and they can still spend it. But the thing is, they do not spend it in the local economy. So, they're not, the rich already have all the consumables they need. So,
they spend it inflating the New York housing market. Well, 50 miles outside of New York, the industrial towns have died. The problem comes when you're tinkering around the edges, and that's what you see the Democratic candidates doing, even the progressive ones, is tinkering around the edges, more consumer protections, more regulations of this and that, when not a single one of them, including Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, or any of them, are attacking the root problem, which is the bank-based economy. The banks stand at the top of the entire Western economic system. They rule international economies. They create the conditions for war and peace. And you see this most particularly in the history of the world wars. I've been reading a great book by a couple of British researchers, Doherty and McGregor, called The Hidden History, The Secret Origins of the First World War. And it was a situation where the population of England had no inclination whatsoever to go to war against Germany or anybody else for that matter. They were very much concerned about their own domestic problems, their employment levels, workers' rights, consumer rights, and yet they were ambushed by the very, very rich at the very top, backed by the bankers who ruled the English economy, and they were led by the nose into a hatred of Germany because the financiers wanted to take Germany down because it was a threat to English financial power. And they did it. And you see that repeated over and over again.
To me, the problem is not banks per se, it's private banks. I mean, it's the fact that we, the people, do not have control of this. Now that we know that banks issue virtually all of our money supply, obviously we, the people, should control that. And profit should go back to the people, and it should stay in the local economy. The problem is now that our money goes to Wall Street, like our public monies, there's city and county and state monies are invested in Wall Street, and they're deposited in Wall Street banks, and then those banks leverage the money out into loans and investments, but they're not investing back in our local economy. So we want to keep it local. We want the profits to go back to the people. And I would say we do need regulation, but the type that circumscribes what the banks can do. In other words, these banks are here to serve the local economy. They need to make productive loans, not speculative loans, etc.
Right, but what do you do when not a single politician will stand for that, even a progressive politician? What we need to have, and I think people increasingly recognize this, is a political revolution. And Bernie Sanders has used that word. Ron Paul has used that word. A lot of other people have used that word. because when the power is in the hands of the financiers and the people who have been bought out by the financiers, which includes most of the political class, to change that requires a complete tearing down and rebuilding of the economic system. Now, that will only happen when this system collapses, and we're seeing it collapse right now.
Yeah, hopefully it won't be too traumatic to getting from here to there. I mean, there are proposals all over the place right now for a global currency reset of different sorts, but none of them sounds to me like they would work. Do you have thoughts on how to fix the whole global problem? Like, we used to have fixed exchange rates, which was fairly stable, and then we got floating exchange rates where it was easy to manipulate or to crash.
Right. Yeah. Well, people in the basic income movement tend to get excited when they hear that, well, Finland's going to have a little experiment, and Alberta in Canada is going to have a little experiment. It can't be done piece by piece, country by country, because suppose you had a monetary revolution in one country and you had prosperity suddenly taking over the way maybe is happening in Iceland now, for instance.
But so China, that's the way it goes. Has the model, you know, is very close to the model we're looking for. They issue their own money. They issue money through their banks, and they issue it through the central bank, and they write off bad debts, which is a form of debt jubilee. I mean, it is a debt jubilee. They're not real open about it. I mean, we know they have a non-performing loan problem, and everybody says, oh, the banks are going to collapse, but they won't collapse unless the government decides to collapse them, and they don't. They prop them up and allow them to.
Yeah, China has done this.
But and, as you say, we, the competitors, are trying to bring them down. It's like, instead of saying, oh, good idea, let's follow their model, we're saying, oh, no, they're our enemies because they're beating us, and so we have to cripple them by taking away their ability to do what they're doing. We should do what they're doing.
Right. Well, our government has labeled China the greatest threat to the U.S., and it's no accident that while that has happened, China's more enlightened financial policies have also been taking place. Yeah, I think that is why China is viewed as a threat, because it is posing an alternative financial system to the predatory financial system of Western nations. And from the largest geopolitical perspective, that seems to be where the battle lines are being drawn right now.
Agreed. It used to be Russia. Well, Russia actually is also breaking away with their financial system. But I suspect that's the way it's going to go, is that Russia and China, and they will form their own system. They'll pull out of the dollar-backed system gradually, maybe relatively gradually.
That does appear to be what is happening. And that's where I say the battle lines seem to be being drawn right now. Because clearly, Iran, for instance, is more in the camp of China and Russia financially than it is with the U.S. And so you see there the continuing attempt by the U.S. to drag down Iran and to produce conditions that will lead to a war with Iran. But on the other hand, you see now Germany and France, the leaders of those countries, wanting to build more bridges to Russia and to support the agreement that was made a few years ago with Iran. So which way will Europe go? I think that's another big question here. At the same time as Great Britain is trying to pull out of the European Union and go back, you know, with the U.S. and stand alone as the nations that support the financial system of high finance and the 1%. Yeah, there's big issues going on, and they're all tied up very intimately, you know, with the kind of things that you write about and the kind of things I've written about. These are the big issues of our era that one way or another have to be solved.
Right. Well, I guess we're getting to the end of our time here. There's so much of interest to discuss. You've also talked a lot about our history and how, you know, where we came from, how we got here, and how we used to, as colonists, you know, had a very good system, and Lincoln also issued his own money, etc. So maybe on another segment we could talk about all that. Great to talk to you for today. Can you tell people where they can find your books and your work?
Yeah, I don't have a website anymore, but I have an author page on Amazon, and people can find my books there. And also, I'm still working on the Space Shuttle Challenger history. Netflix is going to produce a series on the Challenger disaster next year that they interviewed me for. And there's a producer out in Sacramento, California, who is working on a stage play based on my book. That book called Challenger Revealed is available out there, and you can find that on the Amazon author page.
Great.
And then through your website, too.
Right. Yeah, we have all that on our website, publicbankinginstitute.org, under videos. All right. Well, thank you so much for all your work and for your interview.
You too, Ellen. Thank you. Yeah, you keep up the good work. Really enjoy reading your stuff. Thanks.
Thanks. I've been speaking with Richard Cook, author of We Hold These Truths, The Hope of Monetary Reform.
Finally today, we continue our discussion about the operations and history of the Bank of North Dakota, 100 years young this year. How does a government institution manage to thrive for a century without running into some sort of destructive corruption that imperils the whole enterprise? Who makes the decisions about lending money, which is the front line of risk for a bank, and what sort of governance considerations prevail at the Bank of North Dakota? We speak once again with BND historian and author Mike Jacobs, who says bank governance is a broadly shared responsibility.
In practice, many of the day-to-day lending decisions, so to speak, even the large ones, I've forgotten exactly the threshold. I think it's $15 million. Loans of a certain size are reviewed by an advisory committee made up largely of private bankers and other financial managers. So most of those do not become terribly controversial. The smaller loans are generally reviewed by the bank's internal structure, you know, so that there's a group of people who are examining ag loans and community loans and the like. An important innovation that occurred in the 1980s was to require local government participation in loans to fledgling business operations. So I was looking today at some of the loans that the local bank will take a piece of the risk. The state bank will buy down the interest, for example, but the community itself, through its elected officials, is required to put some money on the table. So there's an economic development fund in most North Dakota communities where the local tax base would become part of the assets that the bank would look at. Must look at before it actually advances the money that will get the operation going. And then, you know, there's a favorable interest rate and so on and so forth. So the big challenge for North Dakota today is, and this is the genesis of the Prairie Dog Bill I talked about, is how do you spread economic development and community viability outside of the oil patch? Because, you know, rural America is, even in North Dakota, which is by far the richest of the Great Plains states at this point, excluding potentially Texas, how do you use that resource to help the rest of the state, which doesn't happen to have oil, to continue to be viable? And so decline continues in rural areas outside of the oil patch, you know, with the consolidation of agricultural holdings and the failure of small-town businesses, the widespread population decline. So there's a real effort to try to figure out how can you stimulate an economy in a rural place where you have money, but you don't have opportunity. You know, money and opportunity are not the same thing. So one of the things that I discovered in what I did this morning was just go through the last month's index of newspapers in North Dakota. One of the ways that the bank shows up is in a program that's been established for economic innovation, basically. So entrepreneurs with ideas go to the bank and say, here's an idea. How can we make this work? How can you help me make this work, basically? But the program needs to have the bank's financial people say, yes, this is something that makes sense for Ellendale or Kenmare or whatever, before the bank actually makes the investment. And the loan programs actually kick in, the tax breaks actually kick in, and so on. So that's a new kind of effort that the state is undertaking. There are local community development efforts where the state is trying to make Main Street businesses around the state more attractive through tax breaks and targeted investments and the like. The bank is involved in all of that sort of thing in an effort to basically make the rest of the state comparably successful with the oil boom counties. And comparably is a loose word here, because there's no community in the number of rural communities in the state that are growing outside of the oil counties would be single digits at best, and probably the population decline and the loss of services, the loss of commercial amenities, the closing of schools continues apace in much of rural North Dakota. That's why the Prairie Dog Initiative is so important, to spread the success of the oil counties across the state. The bank is where you go to get this is glib. The bank is where you go to get your share of the pie. But in order to get your share of the pie, you have to have a pretty good idea. You have to have something that you can impress relatively tight-fisted bankers, public bankers, with. You're not going to go into the bank and say, I want to open who knows what in wherever. You have to have a well thought out plan. So you might think of the bank almost as an angel investor in that kind of case. It's impossible to know how much of the success of this enterprise is due to the size of the population of the state, to the transparency in government operations, to the closeness that North Dakotans feel for one another. It's really one community with a long main street, we like to say. So there's a level of familiarity and trust that might not... And I have no empirical evidence of this, but that might not exist in states where there are larger populations that don't have quite the stitching together, the close weave that North Dakota does. That doesn't mean we like each other. That's not the point here. It's that we know each other.
That's Mike Jacobs, historian and author of the centennial book for the Bank of North Dakota, From Surviving to Thriving, The First 100 Years. You'll find links to this excellent book at the Bank of North Dakota website, and it's available through your local booksellers or Amazon.com. Thanks once again to Mike for his contribution to this program. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.